In central London, there's a church, St. Martin's in the Field. It has been there for centuries. It's a beautiful little church, little village at the time when it was built. And over the years, people felt a great ownership towards that building. And they would, well, at late at night, if somebody died in the family, they would sneak into the church and go down into the basement and dig a hole and put Uncle Charlie down there and cover it up and would leave. And then Uncle Charlie would be there for all eternity. And they did this for many, 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 many years. So many years, so many bodies buried in the basement of the church that the vestry had to put out this note, a sign on the outside of the church. This is what it says. By order of the vestry, no one is to bring any more bodies into the basement of this church. The foundations of the church have been disrupted because of so many bodies. The stability of the building is being curiously impaired. No one is to bring a body into this basement for burial without the expressed approval of the vestry. That's kind of a funny sign. You know, you got to imagine it. But it's a great image for us because I believe that the foundation of the church is built on the bodies of the saints, of the people that have been here before us, of the people that caused this church to be many years ago. And every church has a wonderful history. We stand on the shoulders of countless generations that have gone ahead of us. And we use a sanctuary here that very few of us had anything to do with building. We have inherit a ministry that most of us have played a very small part in creating. We stand on the shoulders of those who have gone ahead of us. In a very true sense, this ground, the ground upon which you stand, we meet to worship, we meet to work and to pray. This ground is holy ground. Search committee for a new pastor was having difficulty making a decision. One member of the committee offered one last letter of introduction. Came from a pastoral candidate, and she read the letter. This is what it said. To the pastor search committee, it is my understanding that you have a vacancy in your pulpit, and I would like to apply for that position. I can't say that I preach too well. In fact, I tend to stutter when I speak. I do have a lot of different experiences I could share with you since I am over 75 years old. I have only just recently had an encounter with God, and despite my initial resistance to the idea, I heard a voice which told me personally that I was the one to do the ministry for you. One never knows when God will appear right before your very eyes. As far as people skills go, I do tend to lose my temper every once in a while. I also tend to want things done my way and can get violent if it's not taken care of the right way. Once I even killed somebody. But since I know you are a gracious people, I know that you will believe me when I say it's all behind me now. I intend on showing up there in a few weeks to lead you into a brighter future. Although I was reluctant at first to work with you, I still feel called to be with you nonetheless. And the committee member glanced up to the rest of the group. Well, what do you think? Can this person be our leader or not? The rest of the committee, they were aghast, having an old, arrogant, temperamental, obviously neurotic ex-murderer as their pastor. Was this committee member crazy? Who signed the letter? Who had such colossal nerve? And the committee member eyed them all keenly before she said, "It's signed, Moses." Yeah, Moses was a very unlikely person in an unlikely place to meet God. And suddenly, amid the sagebrush and the sand, the message came that he was standing on holy ground. It may have been that most of us meet God when we do meet God in unlikely places. Moses found that most of us are instinctively looking for. We are searching for that which is holy. When we take the time to stop and to think about life, we inevitably find ourselves searching for something. Something that is larger than us, something that is special, something that is holy. Oh, sure, I mean, we can live as if there's no God. We can ignore God while we bask in the ignorance of our youth, diverting our attention through the pursuit of things and thrills and excitement. But sooner or later, we will come face to face with the hard questions of life. And we find an emptiness at the center of our lives. And that's when we find ourselves yearning for something more. That's when we find ourselves yearning for something holy. Now, there's always been this studies about done about why young people, when they come into the church, we lead them in vacation Bible school, and they participate in youth group, and they go off to college, and we lose them for a while, and then they come back. At one time, somebody said that, well, it's because they have children, and they need help with their children. That's a worthy reason to come back to the church. It's a worthy reason to come back to your faith. But I think it's more than that. Because I think that within each of us, there burns this small little flame of wanting to know that there is purpose to life, wanting to know that there is something greater than you. You've been able to explore your world. You've been able to get your education. You've been able to put your life together. And young people look at that, and then when they finally get honest with themselves, they say, is that it? Is that all that there is? And what they're searching for then when they come back into the church is they're looking for that thing that is holy, that thing that is larger than themselves. Moses found himself on the backside of the wilderness, running from his past, wondering what life would hold for him, and then he was surprised by something holy. He's standing on holy ground. Take off your shoes. He had an experience of holy ground at the burning bush, and it served as a wake-up call to him, and his life changed forever because of it. Elizabeth Barrett Browning once said, "Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. And only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit around and pluck blackberries." Find it interesting. Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush alive with God. I mean, what made that site so holy? That place is not holy today. Nobody knows where the burning bush was. Some people have speculated that another person standing next to Moses probably wouldn't have seen a thing at all that was unusual. It was never holy before and never holy after, but that day, at that moment, it was holy ground because God was there and God was speaking. And Moses is curious enough to turn aside and listen. I've had the opportunity to visit many of Christianity's greatest shrines. I've been to Jerusalem, throughout the Holy Land. I've walked into what they think was the upper room. I've actually swam, and I did a really, really bad surf. What do you, when you surf on a board, you know, with a big kite? Yeah, I did that too, and they had to come out and rescue me. I was out in the storm on the Sea of Galilee. We've been to places where Protestantism was born. Deborah and I, 5 years ago, we went to the largest cathedral in the world, the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, and had an opportunity to explore that. And then we went to Notre Dame, and we've been to the Familia Sagrada in Barcelona. These are shrines in Christianity. These are places that people consider to be holy ground. We have been there to see those things, to be confronted with that which is holy. But as I walked through those things, I didn't feel so holy. Even in the Vatican, as we're wandering around and I'm spouting out all the boring history that I can. Don't ever ask me anything about history, because it's like asking me, you know, what time it is and I build you a watch. You know, I love history, but Deborah was very tolerant. What is that? I said, well, that's one of the popes. She says, well, looks realistic. I said, no, that's one of the popes. He's been dead for 300 years and they have him on display here. And Deborah was ready for lunch at that point, but I think we're done here. But the thing was, you know, it was nice and it was beautiful, but it wasn't holy. It was the only thing that was holy, I think, when we went to worship at Notre Dame and they were having a worship service. There was something holy about that. As they had the incense and they swung it out, there was something really special about that. And even in the Vatican, when a choir started to sing in one of the chapels, that was a holy moment. The rest of it was beautiful and it was wonderful in its way, but it wasn't holy. But then it became holy. Why? Because God was there. People travel miles and miles and miles to experience that kind of thing. Often we look for a special place or a dramatic moment when we can find God or do God's will, but when it actually comes to giving our lives to God, any place will do. It doesn't matter. Anywhere can happen. Any place where we make commitments of our lives to Christ can be for us a burning bush moment of decision. That's where it happened for Moses. That's where he met God. That's where he had a life-changing experience. And that's where he accepted God's commission to lead the Hebrew people out of slavery and into the promised land. And for you to be confronted with God and to have an experience with God, you do not have to search after that same bush. Any bush will do. Whatever it is that causes you to open your heart to God can be for you an experience similar to Moses' experience of the burning bush. Because this is how God confronts us. Throughout this week, this church has been seeking to do that. Confronting God with these children, showing them who God is, singing about it, praying about it, telling them the stories, just being there with them. They're just children. But they can be our burning bush, and we can be theirs. And this experience can cause this ground upon which you are sitting to be holy. That is how God confronts us. For many of us, we attend church the way that we search for the holy, though. Each person here today, you come here by choice. For us, it's a turning aside from other involvement. We come here in searching for the holy. We believe that by turning aside from everything else, we have the possibility of meeting God. And so we gather here to worship and to pray and to think about the things of God. Our coming into this place is our way of taking off our shoes and hoping that this too will be holy ground. For any ground can be holy ground if God chooses so. When we are found by God, no matter what time or what place it is, we're standing on holy ground. Now, back in the old days, when you wanted to visit dead people, you simply went to the church. Sometimes that is still true. I think it is unfortunate that we don't have cemeteries next to churches much anymore. But if you visit any old cemetery, any old graveyard in St. Augustine, in Charleston, any old place, some of the churches and cemeteries have been there for hundreds of years, and there's a sense there of connection with other people. Connection with those who are buried around the church. The people who were buried there are the ones that built the church, who were that church for so many years. And the best sense of the word, they are still that church, at least a part of it. And I find that cemeteries and memorial gardens, they're inspiring, almost comforting, because when I'm there, I don't think of ghosts. I think of people who made unique contributions to society. I think of the saints who have gone before us. I get not only a sense of history, but a sense of wonder at the generation of people that it takes to make up a church. Where would we be without the philosophy of Plato, the curiosity of Copernicus, the devotion of Teresa of Avila, the discoveries of Pasteur, the art of Da Vinci, the music of Bach, the literature of Shakespeare, the theology of Augustine, or the courage of Rosa Parks? We build upon the legacy that has been left to us. We give thanks for the saints who have gone before us, not because they were out of the ordinary or terribly saintly. We give thanks for the saints simply because they were unique and had gifts to offer, and so do we. Now, how many of you that stood up helping with Vacation Bible School, and that was everybody, how many of you went to Vacation Bible School as a child? Remember? Yeah. Wasn't it great? What a wonderful experience. And the people that taught you are probably dead now. Most of them. I mean, some of you have been around for a while, and so I can do the math, you know. And I'm not a brain surgeon, but I can figure that out. Or as Deborah says, do rocket surgery. The truth is, you stand on the shoulders of people that taught you in Vacation Bible School. These children will one day look back on this experience and remember Romper. Remember Emma Jane, remember Ann, Chuck, and all the other folks that did stuff here with them this week. It is because we are connected to God in this way. We give thanks for the saints simply because they gave what they had. Any ground can be holy ground if God chooses it. And when we are found by God, no matter what time or what place it is, that's our holy ground. Now, Ben Stein, political commentator, comedian, interesting guy. He wrote a little article that I want to share with you that talks about people. Let me read this to you. He said, "I no longer think that Hollywood stars are terribly important. They are uniformly pleasant, friendly people, and they treat me better than I deserve to be treated. But a man or woman who makes a huge wage for memorizing lines and reciting them in front of a camera is no longer my idea of a shining star that we should all look up to. How can a man or a woman who makes an eight-figure wage and lives in an insane luxury really be a star in today's world? If by star, we mean someone bright and powerful and attractive as a role model. Real stars are not riding around in the backs of limousines or in Porsches or getting trained in yoga or Pilates or eating only raw fruit while they have Vietnamese girls do their nails. We can be interesting, nice people, they can, but they are not heroes to me anymore. A real star is the soldier of the 4th Infantry Division who poked his head into a hole in a farm near Tikrit, Iraq. He could have been met by a bomb or a hail of AK-47 bullets. Instead, he faced an abject Saddam Hussein and the gratitude of all the decent people in the world. A real star is the U.S. soldier who was sent to disarm a bomb next to a road north of Baghdad. He approached it, the bomb went off, and killed him. A real star is the kind who haunts my memory night and day as the U.S. soldier in Baghdad who saw a little girl playing with a piece of unexploded ordnance on a street near where he was guarding a station. He pushed her aside, threw himself on it. Just as it exploded, he left a family desolate in California and a little girl alive in Baghdad. The stars who deserve media attention are not the ones who have lavish weddings on TV, but the ones who patrol the streets of Mosul even after two of their buddies were murdered and their bodies battered and stripped for the sin of trying to protect Iraqis from terrorists. We put couples with incomes of $100 million a year on the covers of our magazines. The non-coms and officers who barely scrape by on military pay but stand on guard in Afghanistan and in Iraq and on ships and submarines are anonymous as they live and die. I am no longer comfortable being a part of the system that has such poor values, and I do not want to perpetuate those values by pretending that who is eating at Morton's is a big subject. There are plenty of other stars in the American firmament. The policemen and women who go off on patrol in South Central have no idea if they will return alive. The orderlies and paramedics who bring in people who have been in terrible accidents and prepare them for surgery. The teachers and nurses who throw their whole spirits into caring for autistic children. The kind men and women who work in hospices or in cancer wards. Think of each and every fireman who was running up the stairs at the World Trade Center as the towers began to collapse. Now you have my idea of a real hero. We are not responsible for the operation of the universe, and what happens to us is not terribly important. God is real, not a fiction. And when we turn over our lives to Him, He takes far better care of us than we could ever do for ourselves. In a word, we make ourselves sane when we fire ourselves as the directors of the movies of our lives and turn the power over to Him. I came to realize that life lived to help others is the only one that matters. This is my highest and best use as a human. I can put it in another way. Years ago, I realized I could never be as great an actor as Olivier or as good a comic as Steve Martin or Martin Mull or Fred Willard or as good an economist as Samuelson or Friedman or as good a writer as Fitzgerald or even remotely close to any of them. But I could be a devoted father to my son, husband to my wife, and above all, a good son to the parents who had done so much for me. This came to be my main task in life. I did it moderately well with my son, pretty well with my wife, and well indeed with my parents, with my sister's help. I cared for and paid attention to them in their declining years. I stayed with my father as he got sick, went into extremis, and then into a coma, and then entered immortality with my sister and me reading him the Psalms. This was the only point at which my life touched the lives of the soldiers in Iraq or the firefighters in New York. I came to realize that life lived to help others is the only one that matters, and that it is my duty in return for the lavish life God has devoted to me to help others He has placed in my path. This is my highest and best use as a human. By Ben Stein. Remember the last part of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's poem? And the only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit around and pluck blueberries. I think Ben Stein has caught a glimpse of holy ground and has been confronted by saints. And we can do the same thing. But the question is, will we take off our shoes? Or will we blunder right through the desert, immune to the presence of God? Now, during the children's message today, I asked all of you to join all of us as we take our shoes off as an act of specific obedience to God. It seems really strange to be sitting in church in our stocking feet, doesn't it? But God said to take our shoes off when standing on holy ground, and most of us agree this is holy ground, so it's appropriate for us to do it. And shoes are wonderful items. They protect our feet from bumps and bruises, from the cold and from hot, but they also keep us from feeling the warm summer grass or the sand beneath our feet. Shoes are essentially protective gear. They protect us from the environment. If we really want to feel nature, you sometimes have to take off your shoes. But I suspect that wearing shoes can be a metaphor about our relationship with God. When Moses took off his shoes, it was an act of humility, an act of vulnerability. We can't be too uppity in bare feet. We can't be so high and mighty without our shoes. And that's also what it takes to come into the presence of God. We have to have the same mind that was in Christ, who humbled himself and took on the form of a slave. But I especially think that we have to become vulnerable when we come into the presence of God, as we will today throughout this worship service and as we receive communion. How many times, it's a big risk to walk through the house without shoes. How many times have you done that and you've kicked something and you pray a whole lot when you do that? We're without our shoes on, we're vulnerable, aren't we? We're vulnerable to pain, but there's also a corresponding risk in responding to God's claim on our lives. What if Moses had turned aside and had not seen the burning bush? He might have missed the very presence of God. What if he had not taken off his shoes? He might have missed the blessing and the calling of God. This place, where you are right now, can be the holiest place in the world. But if you do not lower our self-protection and make ourselves vulnerable to God, we miss that holy thing. Here again, the words of God. Come no closer. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place in which you are standing is holy ground. Let us pray. Father, we are so thankful that in this place, we are aware of your presence in a powerful way, and it makes this holy. What we do not do for ourselves. The songs that we sing, we do not sing them to ourselves. Everything is focused on you. And so in humble worship, we take our shoes off and we stand on holy ground, vulnerable, ready to receive whatever it is that you would give us. You gave Moses everything he would need for the rest of his life. And we still speak his name with reverence. But it all started with a barefoot man in the desert and a confrontation with you. Confront us as we gather to receive communion, all your people in this church and churches around the world, all of it, holy ground. Amen.